settle your stomach. Do you need a hot water bottle, or I have some bourbon if that will help. How had we gotten so lucky as to land with these people? My eyes watered, which was a sign that my period was, in fact, affecting me. You are kindness embodied. I wiped my fingers under my eyes. Honestly, I am much better. It usually doesn't hit me very hard at all, I guess I just... I waved my hand, hoping she would create her own story from the ambiguity. All the stress of... well, everything you've gone through in the past couple of weeks. She held out the glass of ginger ale. No wonder you're wrung out. I'm fine. But I took the ginger ale, and even the icy chill of the glass was soothing. Really? What about you? Any progress with your church on the refugee front? Myrtle hesitated, then wet her lips. Actually, yes, maybe. We have an idea, but it involves asking you a favor. Oh, God. A chance to be useful? Yes, anything. After everything y'all have done for us, anything I can do is already done. Don't worry. This won't require you to do a thing. She straightened the tray on the desk so it was square with the edges. Eugene says you have a plane. It's damaged, but yes. She nodded as if she already knew this. If he could get it fixed up, can he borrow it? Of course. It was small and petty of me, but I was disappointed that there was nothing more. But I called all the mechanics, and none of them could help. She gave a little smile.
You called all the white mechanics. Not everyone who knows planes is in the phone book. Eugene can get it fixed.
Had she known that there were other mechanics all along and not told me, or was it something that hadn't come up until just now? Either way, resentment was a completely inappropriate response. I owed her. She owed me nothing. It can only hold four. You won't be able to get a lot of refugees in there.
Oh, I know. We've got a different plan.
She straightened and clapped her hands together.
Listen to me, running my mouth off when you don't feel well. Now you just take it easy for the rest of the day, even if you do feel better. I'll leave some chicken broth, no bacon, simmering on the stove for later.
Thank you, but really...
You're fine, I know. You're as bad as Eugene. If I didn't know better, I'd think you were a man.
It's a pilot thing, I guess. I shrugged. I ground you if you're sick.
Well, I don't have daughters, but you're grounded, young lady. I think that's the only way to get you to slow down and take care of yourself.
Slow down? I'd done nothing since the meteorite. I should have gone with Nathaniel. I might have been a tiny bit useful there.
What are you doing in the kitchen?
Myrtle stood in the living room with her hat and gloves still on. With a handful of lettuce poised over a bowl, I somehow suddenly felt guilty. Making dinner?
Girl, you're supposed to be resting.
Sometimes her mid-Atlantic housewife diction disappeared, mostly when she was irritated. I got a sense I was hearing a more honest version of herself. Myrtle set her things down on one of the side tables and came in making shooing gestures.
Go on, back to bed.
I'm fine. There was a little cramping, but really. I put the rest of the lettuce in the bowl and shredded it with perhaps a little more force than was strictly necessary. I should have just buckled up and gone with Nathaniel. I was restless, and you worked all day. Outside, the rumble of Major Lindholm's jeep gave notice that at least one of the men was home. Glancing out the window, I couldn't quite make out the vehicle. Had Nathaniel been kept in meetings? Again? I should have gone. I was an idiot. She pulled open the pantry door and reached inside for an apron.
Well, tell me what I can do.
Check the tagliarini to see if the foil needs to come off. The front door opened and brought with it the sound of Eugene and Nathaniel talking. It seemed like every time he got a chance, Eugene would pump Nathaniel for information about rockets.
Out at Edwards Air Force Base. Oh, Lord, not this again.
Myrtle strode toward the living room.
You are not going to be a test pilot. Fighter was bad enough, but at least there was a war on then. Maybe. We're just talking about the rocket work they're doing.
Nathaniel laughed uncomfortably.
We're comparing the facilities at Sunflower in Kansas to Edwards, that's all. I should go check on Alma. She's in the kitchen.
Nathaniel appeared in the door as I picked up a carrot to grate into the salad. He set his folder of papers down on the kitchen table.
Hey, feeling better?
Yes, thank you. We needed to get him a new briefcase, but it seemed low on the list of priorities. I picked up the grater and ran the carrot over the rough surface with quick downstrokes. How did it go?
Good, thank God.
He loosened his tie and leaned against the counter.
Anything I can do?
Make a cocktail?
Gladly.
We had added to the Lindholm's liquor cabinet as soon as Nathaniel had received his first paycheck from the military. And yes, we stockpiled some under the bed in our room. Currency, in case things really collapsed.
Martini okay?
Perfect. I set the grater aside and scraped the carrots into the bowl with the lettuce. Every time I'd handled food since doing the calculations, I wondered if this was the last year I'd be eating it. But carrots and lettuce? They'd both survive the meteorite winter years, I think. So what did Eisenhower say? Tell me about your brilliance. Nathaniel snorted as he pulled the gin out of the freezer.
Well, you're a brilliant, brilliant husband. Hang on.
He wandered over to the door to the living room and I wanted to scream at him. Such a tease.
Do you all want martinis?
Their hushed conversation broke off and Eugene said,
God, yes. If my wife allows... Ooh!
Thank you, Nathaniel. That would be very much appreciated. Might I have a double?
You could have caught flies with the honey in Myrtle's voice. Chuckling, I rinsed the grater in the kitchen sink. At least there were no issues with clean water here. Some of the refugees had been without it for days by the time they got to us. Of course, the acid rains hadn't reached the Midwest yet. A double sounds like an excellent idea. Nathaniel turned back from the doorway with his brows raised.
And I'm the one who had the meeting.
Medicinal, and you should have a double too. The dressing was already made, but I wouldn't add it until we were ready to eat. That left, checking the tagliarini. You were telling me about Eisenhower and your brilliance.
Ah, right.
He grabbed a pitcher from the cabinet.
Well, after I dazzled them with my rhetoric and awe-inspiring elocution, I stunned Eisenhower into silence by handing him your brilliant in-depth report. Not that he could follow the calculations, but...
See, I didn't need to be there. As I opened the oven door, the heat from it rushed up into my face. 450 degrees. That was cooler than the air that would have hit Washington from the air blast.
Well, I did have to bluff my way past some of his questions.
Nathaniel measured gin into the pitcher.
But he has enough understanding of rocketry from a military perspective to understand that moving the asteroid would have been impossible given the Soviets' current level of technology.
Thank God. I teased the foil off the tagliarini so the cheese could brown, then shut the oven door. What about the weather?
The weather today was lovely.
You know what I mean.
I do. And it's relevant. It's hard to convince people that catastrophic weather changes are coming on a nice day.
The bottle of vermouth was standing on the counter next to him.
Besides, it doesn't have military significance, so he didn't feel the urgency of it.
The bulk of the report was about that. I should have gone with him. Next time. Next time I would have to go. So, do you get to see the president? Is that what happens next? He shrugged and grabbed the ice from the freezer.
I'm trying. Eisenhower said he would attempt to expedite it, but without the Soviet threat... The urgency isn't there. Acting President Brennan is, understandably, busy with restoring the U.S. government.
Ugh. I stood with my hands on my hips and hated myself even more for this morning's lie. If I had been there... What? Would General Eisenhower really have listened to a girl talk about math and weather? Maybe, for the sake of my father, he might have given me time, but I doubt I could have changed his mind. I'm glad I already asked for double, because if they don't make plans...
I know.
He lifted the lever to crack the ice in the tray with such force that a piece hopped out and skittered across the floor.
But one step at a time. They aren't going to attack the Soviets, and that would have been far worse.
It wouldn't have been. Just more immediate. 9.
Pollution defies Europe's borders. Norway finds air waste from abroad a problem. By John M. Lee. Oslo, Norway. April 3rd, 1952. Rising European concern about air pollution deriving from last month's meteor strike found expression in Norway this week when a leading scientist declared, "Our freshwater fish and our forests will be destroyed if these developments continue uncontrolled."
After that glorious week of calculations, my life returned to volunteering at the hospital while we waited to hear from the president. April 3rd. 1 month to the day after the meteor struck. One of the daily refugee planes landed. You would think they would stop coming at a certain point, but there were always more. The people who had survived the initial devastation had held out until it became clear that the infrastructure wouldn't recover anytime soon. I waited in the shade of one of our canvas triage tents as the plane taxied to a stop. Uniformed men ran the stairs out to the plane, and the doctors and nurses waited at the ready. We had a good system down now. The door opened, and the first of the refugees stepped out, gaunt as a rake, and black. I inhaled and turned automatically to look for Myrtle. In the entire month, this was the first black man who had gotten off one of the refugee planes. She had her back to the plane, squaring bandages on a table. Myrtle? Behind me, a murmur of surprise came from the doctors and nurses. Hmm? She looked over her shoulder. Her knees buckled, but she caught herself on the table.
Oh, God! Praise God it worked! Thank you, God, for your mercy!
When I turned back, there was a line of black men, women, and children coming down the stairs. There were white people mixed in, and we saw more as the refugees kept deplaning. First in, last out. The black people had been the last ones they'd let on the plane. As they came closer, their features were easier to make out. Thin, yes, but also pocked with tiny pink sores. Someone moaned. It might have been me. We'd seen the sores from acid rain before, but the damage was so much more apparent on darker skin. I shook myself and picked up my tray of paper cups of electrolytes. Hydration. Someone else would be standing by with sandwiches. Glancing back at Myrtle, I said, "So I guess Eugene finally talked someone into changing the location of the rescue missions, huh?"
"No."
The smile on her face died away.
"No. We used your plane to drop flyers on the black neighborhoods, telling them where to go to be picked up by the refugee planes. But they're here now, and there will be more, and we'll thank God for that."
She picked up a packet of swabs and prepared to meet the incoming wave. 2 weeks later, I'd had ample opportunity to feel guilty for ditching the first meeting about the climate problem like it was a plane on fire. So, feeling the total lack of a parachute, I followed Nathaniel into the meeting with the president, his staff, some cabinet members, and a half dozen other men who served goodness knows what function. I tried to focus on the mundane details to get past the fear. For instance, whoever had decorated this conference room had gone to great lengths to mask the fact that it was an underground bunker. The wood-paneled walls and green carpet evoked a forest glade. Curtains hung over faux windows which were lit from the back with a warm golden light. I clutched my portfolio of papers against my chest and followed Nathaniel into the room. Men in ties and dark suits sat or stood around the room in little knots of conversation. Some stood in front of a chalkboard, where my calculations had been transferred. They stopped talking and turned to stare when Acting President Brannon stood to greet us. He was sunburnt and had wrinkles at the corners of his eyes as though he usually smiled a lot. Not today, though. Lines of strain turned his mouth down, and his hoary gray eyebrows were drawn together with concern.
"Dr. York, Mrs. York."
He gestured to the man next to him, who was rotund and balding, but had a splendidly tailored suit.
"This is Monsieur Scherzinger from the United Nations. I've asked him to sit in on our conversation." "Charmed."
He bent over my hand with a click of his heels, but his eyes strayed to the small scars on my face. Or at least I thought they did. I might have been a little paranoid about my appearance. I had tried to find the line between professional and dowdy, but it likely didn't matter. I was the only woman in the room. Another man with red hair and no chin approached and said,
"Should we get started, Mr. President? We don't want to waste Dr. York's time."
By which he meant that the president was very busy.
"Of course. Thank you, Mr. O'Neill."
President Brannon gestured to the front of the conference room. I kept my gaze fixed upon the chalkboards, scanning the numbers to see if everything had been transferred accurately. It was easier than thinking about the fact that we were about to give a presentation to the president, or at least the acting president. Around us, the men took their seats and stared at the front of the room expectantly. My heart was racing, and my palms stuck to the portfolio with sweat. To look at me, you wouldn't think that it was snowing outside. At least I was only there as a backup in case Nathaniel needed additional calculations to explain the situation. Give me an unpowered landing and I was fine. Addressing a room full of people? Thank you, but no. At the moment, all I wanted to do was get through the afternoon without vomiting. Besides, there was a disturbing consistency to how data presented by pretty young women was treated. It was better all around if it was Nathaniel doing the talking. I set my portfolio down on a little table between the chalkboards. One of them was blank, and there was plenty of chalk in a variety of colors waiting for me. I picked up a piece so I'd have something to do with my hands. The cool, white cylinders soaked up the sweat from my skin. My husband faced the room and waited until he had everyone's attention.
Gentlemen, in the weeks since the meteor, we have been focused on recovery efforts. Hundreds of thousands of people in countries around the Atlantic have been rendered homeless. In some places, the social order has collapsed, leading to rioting, looting, and other atrocities as people compete for scarce resources. My duty today is to tell you that this is not the worst of our problems.
Listening to the rolling, authoritative tone of his speech, it became much easier to remember why he had become something of a celebrity after we launched the satellites.
Many people fear that another meteor will strike. It's a natural fear and why we're buried in this bunker, but the chances of another strike occurring are astronomically small. The danger represented by this equation is not only much greater, but certain.
He gave a rueful smile and shrugged.
For decades, scientists have wondered what happened to the dinosaurs, why they all died off. This might explain it.
He walked to the chalkboard with my equations on it.
I won't expect you to follow the math here, but I will say that it has been checked by top people in geology, climatology, and mathematics.
That last one was only me, but I didn't interrupt him. Nathaniel paused and surveyed the room, gathering their attention. The golden light from the faux window brushed his cheeks, picking out the small scars. Under his dark gray suit, his bruises had faded, and he stood with easy confidence, as if he had never been injured. Taking a breath, Nathaniel tapped the board.
The problem is, gentlemen, that the Earth is going to get warmer. The dust that the meteor kicked up will clear from our skies. The water vapor, that's the problem. It will trap heat, which will cause evaporation, which will put more water vapor into the air, which will, in turn, make the Earth hotter and kick off a vicious cycle that will eventually make the planet unfit for human habitation.
A plump, sallow man on the right side of the table snorted.
It's snowing today in Los Angeles.
Nathaniel nodded and pointed at him.
Exactly. That snow is directly linked to the meteor. The dust and smoke that got kicked into the atmosphere are going to cool the Earth for the next several years. We'll probably lose crops this year, not just in the United States, but globally.
President Brannon, bless him, raised his hand before speaking.
How much will the temperature drop?
Elma?
Nathaniel half turned toward me. My stomach lurched into my throat, and I flipped through the papers in my portfolio to find the one I wanted. 70 to 100 degrees globally. Toward the back of the room, someone said,
Couldn't hear!
Swallowing, I lifted my head from the papers and faced the room. This was no different from shouting over the engine of an airplane. 70 to 100 degrees.
That doesn't seem possible.
The man at the back crossed his arms over his chest. That's just for the first few months? They were focusing on the wrong thing. The temperature drop would be unpleasant, but it was short-term. Then we'll have 3 to 4 years of a global climate that's 2.2 degrees cooler than average before the temperature begins to rise.
2.2? Huh. So what's the big tizzy over?
President Brannon said,
That's more than enough to severely affect crops. Growing seasons will shorten by 10 to 30 days, so we'll have to convince farmers to plant different crops and at different times of year. That's not going to be easy.
As the former Secretary of Agriculture, it wasn't surprising that he intuitively understood the trouble with a change in climate. But he was still focused on the wrong thing. Yes, we had a mini ice age to get through, but none of them were considering the eventual rise in temperature.
Farm subsidies!
Another man, maybe the one who'd said he couldn't hear, leaned across the table.
And got farmers to change their crops during the Great Depression. All of our resources are going to be tied up in rebuilding.
As they argued, Nathaniel stepped back to me and murmured, Will you chart the temperature rise? I nodded and turned to the board, grateful to have something concrete to do. The chalk slid across the surface, shedding shivers of dust with my upstrokes. The notes in my portfolio were there in case I lost my place, but I'd stared at this chart so much over the past couple of weeks that it was etched on the inside of my eyelids. Unseasonable cold for the next several years, then a return to normal, and then the temperature kept rising. The line was slow at first until it reached the tipping point and suddenly spiked upward. When I hit that on the board, Nathaniel stepped forward to the end of the conference table and stood with his hands clasped in front of him. The conversation quieted.
In 1824, Joseph Fourier described an effect that Alexander Bell later called the greenhouse effect. In it, particles in the air cause the atmosphere to retain heat. If the meteor had struck land, the winter would have been longer. The fireball would have been larger. We thought it was fortunate that it struck water, but it's worse. The Earth is going to come out of winter and get hotter. In 50 years, there will be no snow in North America.
The pudgy man who had complained about snow in California laughed.
Coming from Chicago, I gotta say, this doesn't strike me as a problem.
How do you feel about 100% humidity and summers with a low of 120 degrees?
Still, weathermen can't predict if it's going to rain tomorrow. 50 years is a long time out.
President Brannan raised his hand again. He was staring at me. No, at the board. I stepped to the side so he could see it better.
Dr. York, what does the upturn on that chart represent?
That is when the oceans begin to boil.
It was as if a jet engine had sucked the air out of the room.
Someone said,
"You can't be serious, that's..."
President Brannan slapped his hand on the table.
"I hope you'll grant that I know something about the planet and how it behaves. We're having this meeting because I've already looked over Dr. York's figures and consider the problem serious. We're not here, gentlemen, to debate the matter. We're here to decide what to do about it."
Thank God. Brannan was only the acting president until Congress could confirm him, which required having a Congress, which required elections, but still, all the powers of the president were currently invested in him. He surveyed the room and then gestured to Monsieur Scherzinger.
"Will you take the floor?"
"Certainly."
He stood and came to stand by Nathaniel.
"Gentlemen, Mrs. York, there is a saying in Switzerland, ne pas mettre tous les œufs dans le même panier, which you will know in English as, do not put all your eggs in one basket. The United Nations feels that, in addition to reducing the damage here on Earth, we must also look beyond our planet. It is time, gentlemen, to colonize outer space."
Part 2. 10.
UN urged to aid the Ukraine. Special to the National Times. Rome, February 20th, 1956. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization today urged all member governments to consider immediately what assistance they could give to the Ukraine, part of the former Soviet Union, which is threatened with famine after the failure of its crops during the meteor winters. The UN instructed its Director General to continue to give, upon request of the Ukrainian government, all appropriate assistance, technical or other, that lies within his authority and competence.
Do you remember where you were when we put a man into space? I was one of two computer girls sitting in the International Aerospace Coalition's dark room at Sunflower Mission Control in Kansas, with graph paper and my mechanical pencils. We used to launch from Florida, but that was before the meteor and before the NACA became part of the IAC. Sunflower already had a rocket facility from the war, so it made sense to relocate inland, away from the wrecked coast. 3 miles away, the fruit of our labor sat on the launch pad. A Jupiter rocket with Stetson Parker strapped into a tiny pod atop 113 metric tons of propellant. Charming when he wanted to be, even I had to admit that he was a damn fine pilot. Unless we had really screwed up, he was going to be the first human into space. And if we screwed up, he'd be dead. Of the Artemis 7 astronauts, he was my least favorite, but I wanted him to survive this. The banks of instrument panels gave a soft glow to the room, and the sound-dampening panels they'd added to the walls kept voices low, or as low as possible, given a room filled with 123 technicians. The air crackled with electricity. Men paced at the edges of the room. As lead engineer, poor Nathaniel was stuck in the new White House waiting with President Brannon to talk to the press. They had two speeches written, just in case. Across the small light table from me, Hugh Lang, Helen, Lou, played chess with Renard Carmouche, one of the French engineers, while we waited. Helen, the other computer girl, had joined the International Aerospace Coalition as part of the Taiwanese contingent. Apparently, she'd been a chess champion back home, which Mr. Carmouche hadn't quite grasped yet. After liftoff, she'd be in charge of extracting the numbers from the teletype and feeding them to me while I did the calculations to confirm that orbit had been attained. We'd been awake for 16 hours, but I couldn't have slept if you paid me. I really did need something to do with my hands. Myrtle had been trying to teach me to knit, but it hadn't taken. From the small raised platform at the end of the room, the launch director said,
"All positions are go for launch commit."
I breathed out. The launch sequence was familiar and terrifying by this point. But no matter how many things we'd launched, this was the first one carrying a human life. You couldn't help but think about the rockets that had exploded on the pad, or the ones that had made it into space carrying a monkey, only to return a dead creature to the ground. I didn't like Parker, but by God, he was brave. And I was deeply, intensely jealous of him. The mission director replied,
"Roger, launch team, we are go for launch."
Helen turned from the chess game and slid her chair closer to the teletype. I straightened the graph paper in front of me.
"Stand by for terminal countdown. We are T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, ignition."
Parker's voice crackled over the speaker with the roar of the rocket surrounding him.
"Confirm ignition." "2. 1. And liftoff. We have liftoff."
Moments later, the thundering roar of the rocket ignition hit the room in a wave. It pulsed through my chest, even 3 miles away. Even in a concrete bunker. Even with sound dampening on the walls. I broke into a sweat. The only thing louder was a meteorite impact. If you were too close to the rocket during liftoff, the sound waves would literally shred you.
"Confirm liftoff. Manual clock has started."
I picked up my pencil and poised it over the graph paper.
"This is Hercules 7. The fuel is go, 1.2G, cabin pressure at 14 PSI. Oxygen is go."
As the rocket roared into the air, the teletype sprang to life with information from tracking stations across the world. Helen started circling numbers as the text came off the machine. She tore the first piece of paper free and slid it across the table. I sank into the calculations. Raw numbers told the story of position and bearing, and it was my job to use those to reveal the rocket's velocity as it left the Earth. I could see the rocket's smooth, graceful rise in my mind, but plotted the ascent on a piece of graph paper for the men standing behind me.
"Some vibrations. Sky is getting dark now."
That meant Parker was starting to exit the atmosphere. With each piece of paper Helen handed me, the line of the arc I traced continued upward within mission parameters. The roar of the rocket had faded, leaving an eerie silence. Around us, the male voices of engineers at work murmured in a quiet, intense call and response.
"Guidance to report."
Helen read the numbers from my page, her faint Taiwanese accent coming out with her excitement. "Velocity, 2,350 meters per second. Angle of elevation, 4 minutes of arc. Altitude, 101.98 kilometers. Her voice was shockingly high amid the tenors and baritones of mission control. Eugene Lindholm on comm repeated the numbers to Parker. In response, he said,
"Roger, it's a lot smoother now."
The teletype rattled constantly, and Helen slid another page over to me. I held my lower lip between my teeth as my pencil flew across the page. 6,420 meters per second. The first stage engine cutoff should be soon. On the radio,
"Cutoff. Confirm engine cutoff." "I can see the booster falling away."
I glanced at the clock, counting the seconds along with everyone else. Half a minute after the booster dropped away, the escape tower should jettison. He'd be well and truly on his own then.
Tower jettison is green.
Confirm tower jettison?
Momentum carried Parker higher, and with the next page Helen handed me, I started to smile. 8,260 meters per second. Hello, orbital velocity. But I did the calculations on the page anyway to show my work.
Periscope is coming out. Turnaround started.
Confirm turnaround.
Behind me, Mr. Carmouche asked,
"Why are you smiling?"
I shook my head and drew one more dot on the graph at 280 kilometers above the surface. Getting Parker into space was the first step. Achieving orbit required altering his trajectory, and that was all on him.
Switching to manual.
The radio continued to crackle as he left the channel open.
The view is... Wish you all could see this.
Roger. Wish for seeing view confirmed.
Didn't we all wish for that? If he orbited successfully, that got us one step closer to a space station, which got us a step closer to the moon base, and then Mars, Venus, and the rest of the solar system. Helen gave me another sheet from the teletype. I tracked Parker's position by shifts in Doppler frequency. The frequency of those waves showed the rocket's path over the Earth. I plugged the numbers into the string of calculations, and then ran through it again just to be sure. Turning in my seat, I lifted the page over my head. He made it! He's in orbit! Grown men jumped from their seats, shouting like kids at a ball game. One fellow threw paper into the air and it fluttered down around us. Someone clapped me on the shoulder and there was a sudden warm, wet pressure on my cheek. I pulled back, glaring at Mr. Carmouche, whose lips were still puckered from the kiss. We still have to get him home. I wiped my cheek off and set my pencil on the page again. Across the table, Helen met my gaze and nodded. Then she handed me the next sheet of paper. The light from the hall outside our rented apartment fell across the bed. I rolled over as Nathaniel's silhouette entered, muffled by his overcoat. The light from the bathroom reflected only on his shoes and the snow still caught in his trouser cuffs. I'm not asleep. That was mostly true. I'd left the Murphy bed down before I went to Mission Control that morning because I knew we'd both be too tired to deal with it after the launch. Congratulations.
To you as well.
He took off his overcoat and hung it on the peg by the front door. Housing prices in Kansas City had skyrocketed after President Brannon relocated the capital to the center of the country. Between that and all the refugees who needed homes, the only place we could afford, even with a government salary, was a studio apartment. Frankly, I was happy not to have much house to keep up with. I turned on the bedside lamp and sat up. You were wonderful in the press conference.
If by wonderful you mean that I deflected the idiot reporter who thinks the whole program is pointless, then yes. Yes, I was.
He shrugged, pulling on his tie.
I'd rather have been at Mission Control. I could hear you over the radio when they retrieved Parker after splashdown. And here I thought you didn't like the fellow.
How do you know it was me?
First, we've been married for 5 years. Second...
He kicked his shoes off.
You were one of two women in the room, and I don't think you were the one speaking Taiwanese.
Lee Kisi. Helen had taught me to swear, which came in handy with some of the engineers and occasionally my husband. Anyway, I'm allowed to be excited that the mission was a success, and I'm not evil. Or at least not enough to wish him dead for real. Mostly. He crossed the room and bent down to kiss me, tasting of good scotch.
Mostly evil. Yes, I can agree with... Ow! My point's proven.
Reaching up, I undid the top button of his collar. I think... The next button followed, exposing his clavicle and the top of his undershirt. It depends on how one defines evil. Nathaniel traced a finger along the neckline of my nightgown.
I am happy to entertain your definition.
Well... I reached the last button and tugged his shirt free of his trousers. For instance, let's say that one learned something during a press conference that her husband really should have told her. Nathaniel's hand paused at the strap of my nightgown.
Interesting example.
He slid the strap off and bent down to kiss my exposed shoulder.
I might need more specifics.
I inhaled, breathing in muskiness from his aftershave and the sweet earthiness of a fine cigar. For instance, The fact that they are expanding the astronaut corps and removing the test pilot requirement. With my face pressed into his hair, I found his belt by touch. The fabric beneath it was already strained out of shape. My God, I loved a successful rocket launch. Nathaniel nibbled a path from my shoulder to the base of my neck, sending warm currents down to my toes.
Let's say that expanding the astronaut corps was contingent on completion of a mission. Would withholding information about the expansion be considered evil if the motivation was to keep someone's hopes from rising?
Rising hopes. I released the zipper on his trousers, and Nathaniel's hands tightened on my upper arms.
And would that be further mitigated if, for instance, a certain briefcase contained an application? For someone who is, say, a World War II pilot, had logged the requisite flight time and fit the right height and weight requirements. Oh, God.
He cleared his throat, and his breath was hot against my neck.
I'll take that as a yes.
Confirmed. Evilness mitigated, but... I slid back on the bed, pulling my nightgown off as I did. With my arms over my head and the cool night air bringing my breasts to full attention, I also commanded my husband's full attention. It's the action one would take to protect a child. Am I a child?
God, no.
He shrugged out of his dress shirt and peeled his undershirt off. The bedside lamp caressed the curve and flex of his abdomen. After the meteor, Nathaniel had begun working out. He was not alone in that drive to be more prepared for what-if scenarios, but my heavens, did I ever appreciate the result. I threw my nightgown to the side. His gaze stayed fixed on me, and his mouth hung a little open, as if his brain were trying to acquire extra oxygen to compensate for a redirected blood flow. So, I have to ask, why wouldn't one tell an adult? I regretted the question almost immediately because this one made him pause. On the other hand, he paused in the act of sliding his trousers and underwear off in one motion so I could appreciate the V of his abdomen as it joined his pelvis and the dark hair at the base.
Because they were going to cancel the entire program if the launch had failed.
By fail, he meant if Parker had died. Nathaniel slid his trousers the rest of the way off.
The snow. People think that the warming isn't coming, so...
I reached for him and he slid between my legs, pushing me back to lie on the bed with his warmth pressed against my full length. Wrapping one thigh around his leg, I pressed up into Nathaniel and his eyes fluttered closed. Warming is definitely coming.
Yes.
He shifted so he could reach between us. His fingers found the bright bundle of delight between my legs and, sparked my ignition sequence. Everything else could wait. Oh God, we are go for launch. 11.
IAC is spurring rocket program. 75 to 105 vehicles will be fired in 3-year schedule, Chief says. By Bill Becker, special to the National Times. Kansas City, Kansas, March 3rd, 1956. The International Aerospace Coalition plans to launch 75 to 105 major rockets in the next 3 years, thereby expecting to have a colony on the moon by 1960.
Do you remember where you were when the meteor struck?
At the front of the synagogue, our rabbi looked over the congregation. I don't know about anyone else, but my eyes instantly burned with the threat of tears. Of course, I remembered. Behind me, I heard another woman sniffle. I wondered where she had been 4 years ago on March 3rd, 1952. Had she been in bed with her husband? Had she been preparing breakfast for her children? Or had she been one of the millions of people who didn't hear about it until later?
I was counseling a young couple, newly engaged, who were facing all the joys of their upcoming marriage. My secretary knocked on the door. She never does this. She opened the door and she was weeping. You all know Mrs. Schwab. Have you ever seen her even without a smile? The radio, she said.
Rabbi Neuberger shrugged, but somehow still conveyed all the grief that followed.
I will always think about that moment
as the threshold between before and after.
He held up a finger.
If that young couple had not been in my office, I would have given way to grief. But they asked me if they should still get married. It seemed as if the world were ending. Should they marry?
He leaned forward and you could hear the held breath of every person in the tense silence around us.
Yes. Marriage, too, is a threshold between before and after. We have many of these every day, which we do not recognize. The threshold is not the question. There will always be befores and afters. The question is, what do you do after you cross that threshold?
I wiped under my eyes with the thumb of my glove and it came away dark with mascara.
You live. You remember. This is what our people have always done.
Outside the synagogue, bells began to sound across the city. Probably across the country and maybe across the planet. I didn't have to look at my watch. 9:53 a.m. I closed my eyes and even in the darkness, even 4 years later, I could still see the light. Yes, I remembered where I was when the meteor struck. I did not even make the first cut. I was consoling myself with a piece of carrot cake in the IAC cafeteria, and as a side note, let me say that the best thing about the international part of the International Aerospace Coalition was that it meant the cafeteria had a French pastry chef. But I digress. So the carrot cake and I were sitting at a table with Helen, Basira, and Myrtle. When we'd been living with Myrtle, I'd had no idea she'd worked as a computer during the war until she signed on with the IAC 2 years ago. Masira, who had come to us from Algiers, made a face.
So, then he tried to show me how to use a slide rule.
No, for a differential equation?
Myrtle, the only other American in our group, covered her mouth and laughed until her cheeks turned red.
What a buffoon!
I know.
Masira put on a terrible American accent.
Well, little lady, this here is a mighty fine instrument.
Helen had her hands clapped over her mouth and was cackling like a Taiwanese banshee, if there were such a thing.
Tell them where he hold it.
With a snort, Basira glanced around the cafeteria, but it was the end of the day shift, so it was largely empty. I lowered my fork, making a guess, and yep. She placed her hand in her lap as if the slide rule were, well, prepared for liftoff.
I can show you how to use it.
I laughed, picturing Leroy Pluckett with his wispy sideburns and loud ties trying to come on to Basira. With her height and dark, smooth complexion, she had easily won Miss Outer Space at the company holiday party last winter, plus her accent was to die for. The company of these women was a newfound joy to me. The NACA computing department had been all women, yes, but due to segregation laws in D.C., they had all been white women. If you told me 4 years ago that I was going to be one of only two white women in my group of closest friends, I would have laughed. I'm ashamed of that now. The International Aerospace Coalition, which President Brannan had convinced the UN to form, changed everything. Well, the meteor had changed everything. But having a Quaker for a president did a lot to alter hiring practices all the way down the line, and I couldn't be luckier to have these friends as a result. Helen wiped her eyes and looked over my shoulder.
Hello, Dr. York.
Good evening, ladies.
He rested his hand on my shoulder briefly in lieu of a public kiss.
What are you laughing about?
Slide rules.
Helen folded her hands demurely in her lap,
and their uses.
Which set us off again. Poor Nathaniel just watched the laughter, smiling with us, but otherwise clueless. Which reminded me that I would have to talk to him about Leroy Pluckett. It made for a funny story, but I didn't like him coming into our department and disrupting it. Technically, personnel issues were Mrs. Rogers' job, but I was the one who was sleeping with the lead engineer, so I was in a better position to fix it than the other women. Wiping my eyes and still chuckling, I slid my chair back.
Looks like my ride is here.
Are you not going to finish that cake?
Myrtle reached across the table.
It's all yours.
Nathaniel picked up my coat from the back of my chair and held it up for me. This July was almost warm enough to not need it, but not quite yet. Summer was coming, sooner than we liked. I waved goodbye to the women. See y'all tomorrow. A chorus of goodbyes followed us across the cafeteria amid bubbles of laughter. Nathaniel took my hand.
You seem to be in a better mood.
Well, cake helps. And getting a rose from you.
I'm glad you liked it.
He waved to one of the other engineers as we walked down the hall toward the front doors of the IAC.
I learned something today that might also cheer you up.
Oh? I stopped by the door to let him open it for me. Do tell. The late evening sun cut across the parking lot, but did little to stave off the chill air. Pulling my coat a little tighter around me, I went out and walked with Nathaniel toward the bus stop. Beyond the fence that surrounded the IAC campus, kids waited with autograph books, hoping for a glimpse of one of the astronauts. They spotted Nathaniel and once again settled for the lead engineer of the space program. I let go of his hand and stepped to the side as the kids swarmed around him. Thank heavens they had no interest in the engineer's wife. It was like watching a feeding frenzy with autograph books in lieu of teeth. He ran the gauntlet nearly every day, and I suspected that it was one of the reasons he often worked so late. Well, that and my husband's inherent nature. The kids weren't the only rocket enthusiasts. After he worked his way clear of them, Nathaniel waited until we had walked down the block toward the bus stop to get back to his news.
Well?
He glanced behind us.
This is not technically classified, since the final list of the astronauts will make it clear, but...
I won't mention anything until the final list is published. Not even the first cut. I hadn't expected to make the final team, not really. But with my logged flight time, I thought I'd at least get past the first cut.
Director Clemens did not select any women. At all.
Stopping dead in my tracks, I stared at him. The head of the IAC, Director Norman Clemens, a man I had worked with for years and someone I had respected, had not selected any women? Breath steamed in front of me as my mouth hung open. How is that supposed to make me feel better?
Well, because you know it wasn't you, right?
But there wasn't anything in the requirements about being male. Nathaniel nodded.
Clemens said he thought it would have been self-evident because of the dangers.
Oh, my God. I accepted that piece of patriarchal stupidity for test flights, but now? We're trying to establish a colony. How exactly does he expect to do that without any women?
I think...
He hesitated and looked down the street. His eyes squinted against the breeze. There were times when Nathaniel really couldn't tell me things, because they were classified, and when he hit one of those walls, he always looked vaguely constipated. Right now, it looked as if he were holding something huge. What? He licked his lips and shifted his weight.
There was some... concern about the stresses of space.
Stresses. Women handle G-forces better than men. The WASPs established that during the war and... I broke off at the sudden compression of his lips, as if he were biting back words. You are kidding me. They think we'll get hysterical in space? Nathaniel shook his head and gestured toward the bus stop.
I thought we might go dancing tonight.
Grinding my teeth, I jammed my hands into my coat pockets. Why not a show while we're at it? If I had to lay money on who had objected to the fitness of women for the space program, I'd pick one man, Stetson Parker. I will grant that Nathaniel was right and that I wasn't sad anymore, but anger was perhaps not what he had intended to inspire. By the time we reached the weekend, I was still angry. If I had tried my best and failed, it would have been different. I could have dusted myself off and tried harder next time. This? This was maddening because there was nothing I could do to change it. If you haven't gathered by now, I don't do well with helpless. So I headed out to the private airfield where our local branch of the 99's Flight Club met. The first rule of Flight Club was, well, actually the first rule was safety, but after that it was ground is for griping, planes are for planning. In-air conversations did not return to the ground. Which is why I started this particular conversation on the ground. I wanted at least some gossip to arise from it. I looked around at the circle of women. When the original 99s formed, they took their name because there were only 99 women pilots in the United States. Now there were thousands of us in different clubs across the nation, and I was betting that all of us had the same ambitions. Who else applied for the astronaut corps? Everyone's hands went up, except Pearl, who was still plump from having triplets, and Helen, who didn't have her license yet. I'd gotten her hooked on flying at the 4th of July party last year. Her father still hadn't forgiven me. It was Betty's turn for pre-flight refreshments, and she had brought lemon beet cookies. I'd been dubious when they first made an appearance, but these could be made despite the sugar shortages, and they were tart, sweet, and delicious. She set the plate down on the rough wooden picnic table, set up in the corner of the hangar. Her movie star red lips twisted into a pout.
I didn't make the cut.
I snatched a bright pink cookie from the plate. None of us did. The other women turned on me with expressions ranging from surprise to suspicion. Pearl wrinkled her pert little nose. How do you know that? Because, I broke the cookie in half. They didn't take any women. Why? On what grounds? Betty snorted and grabbed her bosom, which was magnificent.
Obviously, these get in the way of the controls.
Speak for yourself. Helen ran her hands down her flight suit, which accentuated her boyish figure.
Seriously, though, I thought they were trying to establish colonies.
Nodding, I avoided any of the things Nathaniel had hinted at. They'll be doing a formal announcement of the list at a press conference next week. Betty perked up and grabbed for her bag.
You don't say.
She pulled out her reporter's notepad. I cleared my throat. Obviously, I don't say. But someone with a tie to a major newspaper would probably be invited and...
Nuts.
She glared at the pad.
They'll probably give it to Hart. He's getting all the prime international stuff. I swear to God, if I have to cover one more garden club...
You'll do it and be grateful for the paycheck. Pearl twisted her gloves in her hands.
Betty sighed. You could have at least let me rant a little longer before bringing reality into this.
The thing is, I cut in, pointing my cookie at Betty. Do you think he'll notice an all-male list? She narrowed her eyes, and I could see her formulating the pitch she'd use with her editor.
Can I cite you as a source at the IAC, not by name?
I don't want to get, my source in trouble. Betty snatched the cookie out of my hand.
If you think that little of my...
I snatched it back, and crumbs went flying. Laughing, I popped the tart morsel into my mouth. I just want to make sure the parameters are clear.
Parameters confirmed.
She grabbed her flight jacket and stood.
Shall we fly?
Absolutely. I tucked another cookie into the pocket of my flight jacket and glanced at Helen. Going up with me or one of the other girls?
Wouldn't miss it.
My little Cessna 170B could carry four people. Betty had a Texan, but it wasn't any good for conversation. So she decided that, given the topic, she'd start with us so we didn't have to use the radio to talk. We piled into the cockpit and put the conversation on hold while I went through the pre-flight checklist. There is something magic about takeoffs. I know people who are afraid of flying who say that the takeoffs and landings are the only hard parts. Perhaps because that's when the act of flying is most apparent. I love the way you get pushed back into your seat, the weight and the sense of momentum press against you, and the vibrations from the tarmac hum through the yoke and into your palms and legs. Then suddenly, everything stops and the ground drops away. It never feels like I'm rising, but that the ground is falling away from me as if I were light as air. Maybe that's what frightens people. Or maybe I'm not frightened because my dad flew with the Air Force when it was still part of the Army and had taken me on my first plane ride when I was 2 years old. I'm told that I laughed the entire flight. Clearly, I don't remember that. I do remember begging him to do barrel rolls when I got a little older. Most kids, their dad teaches them to drive. Mine taught me to fly. Anyway, once we were up in the air... I turned us in a lazy spiral away from the airfield just to get a feel for the air today. Betty sat in the co-pilot seat with Helen behind us. Betty turned to address both of us, shouting a little over the engine.
All right, flight club rules are in effect. Am I right that they want to turn the moon into a military base?
From all the things Nathaniel isn't saying, I think it's actually that women are too emotional to go into space. Betty shook her head, and I'm fairly certain she cursed under the sound of the airplane.
Right. This is Hogswallow, and we need to change it.
How? Helen leaned forward in her seat.
I can pitch this to my editor as discrimination, but that's not going to take if I can't also talk about some of the women who were passed over.
She looked at me.
I can do it in ways that won't make my sources clear, and I can also prime Hart to ask the question and bring it front and center at the press conference.
I glanced sideways at her. How? I mean, that feels very direct.
Mr. President, with an all-male astronaut corps, is there a danger that the communist bloc will perceive this as a military outpost rather than a colony?
Helen raised her hand as if to remind us that she was from Taiwan. He'll counter with international cooperation. I nodded. We've got people at the IAC from Taiwan, Algeria, Spain, Brazil, France, Germany, Serbia, Haiti, the Congo. Helen chimed in. Belgium, Canada, Denmark, France, Iceland, Italy, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, the United Kingdom, and the U.S.
Betty shook her head. And none of those are communist countries.
Okay, but it still doesn't talk about the hysteria aspect.
No, but it does highlight the all-male astronaut corps, and that gives us leverage for a follow-up about why there are no women.
She snorted.
And it's an election year. Eisenhower is running against Brennan, so I'm going to bet money right now that a return to normalcy with women relegated back to being homemakers is going to be a key election issue.
Cold ran all the way to the center of my body. But the director of the IAC doesn't answer to the president. He... Even as the words left my mouth, I knew I was being stupid. The IAC might be an international effort, but because the launch center was on American soil, we had more influence on the program than other countries, even with a British director. And I'd seen the list of astronauts. Fully three-quarters of them were American or British. All of them were white. Everyone buckled up? They both said yes, but didn't ask me why. They knew me well. I pulled the plane up, gaining altitude, and looped us over. Centrifugal force kept us pushed into our seats. The earth lay spread out below in a quilt of green and brown. There was enough haze in the sky that the line between ground and air was indistinct, and the edges blurred away into the silver white of the sky. I'd seen pictures from orbit. The earth turned into a blue-green globe. I wanted to float weightless in space and see the stars with all their startling clarity. If these men, with their constant jockeying for dominance, dragged us back into the dark ages, I would... What? Bringing the plane out of the loop, I took us into a barrel roll. Silver and green spun about, with us as the center of the pinwheel. Behind me, Helen laughed and clapped her hands. Coming out of the roll, I considered my next option. People were losing sight of the greenhouse timeline, since this was a slow disaster. We needed to establish colonies on the moon and the other planets while we had the resources to spare. If their excuse was that establishing a colony wasn't safe for women, then we'd need to prove that women were just as capable as men. Do you think your newspaper would be interested in covering an all-women air show?
Hell yes.
Betty jabbed her finger at me.
But only if I get to use your name.
I'm not anyone.
You're married to the lead engineer at the IAC. That story about you flying out after the meteor, I can use that.
I swallowed. Being the center of attention was necessary. And it would just be talking to Betty. Sure, you can do that. 12.
Men of the Space Age. National Times photographs by Sam Falk. March 26, 1956. The rocket specialists, those who think up, design, engineer, and fire the mighty engines to carry scientific instruments aloft, are the men to whom the country looks for achievement in the space age. They work in many fields, ranging from fuels to computer systems and from alloys to communication techniques. The best known of these is Dr. Nathaniel York, who is the lead engineer for the International Aerospace Coalition.
The press conference went exactly as Betty predicted. When questioned about the exclusively male list, Norman Clemens, the director of the IAC, said that it was for safety considerations, and it was much the same as when Columbus discovered the New World, or Shackleton's trip to the North Pole. No one had been concerned that there were no women on those expeditions. He was sure that the international